Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora, published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. In the last episode, the trial of Russ Gorman was looming closer, and Captain Laughlin wanted to prepare Amy's St. Lawrence sister for what would happen at the trial. We proceed with Finding Amy on page 202, and this is episode 19. On the crowded second floor of the restaurant, the four of us are snuggled in at our table. My rocks and salt margarita gradually readies me for the difficult conversation we've come here to have. Lucille is the first to speak over the din of the restaurant, trying to lay the groundwork for what I've got to say. Julie tosses her long blonde hair back, apprehensive but brave and curious, staring ahead as she fidgets nervously. Tim gives her what I think is a protective hug. I realize this is the first time I've really looked into Julie's eyes. Bright, smart, blue eyes. They are usually downcast and sad. "We wanted to talk about the trial and the realities of what you'll experience," Lucille says. I grab my cue, leaning in, trying to be heard over the din without sharing this with the whole restaurant. "Julie, it's not like TV, or in the movies, or on the news. A real trial isn't like that. It's going to be hard and frustrating." But broad strokes like this won't help her. She needs the gritty details in plain talk. First of all, you will see Gorman up close and have to sit near him in the courtroom every day. I'm sure he will be cleaned up for presentation. How many times have I seen it? A brutal thug comes into court groomed and shaved and wearing a suit and tie, and the jury just can't believe such a nice person could do a terrible crime. You are going to hear things that are not true about your sister. They may try to twist things around. Defense attorneys do that. There's very often an attempt to blame the victim. It can get pretty one-sided sometimes. The jury will not hear the whole story. Certain evidence and witnesses may be excluded. The prosecution won't be able to talk about Gorman's past or criminal history. Yet the defense can say anything they want about Amy. Julie interrupts, wanting to know why Gorman's history gets excluded. I explain as best I can, and go on with what I think she needs to know, trying to give her a realistic picture of a jury trial without letting my own black cynicism bleed through. They will manipulate the truth, and you must remain calm and controlled when people lie or turn things around on the stand. You're going to hear about the crime scene and the condition of your sister's body. It will be ugly and upsetting and hard to listen to. It's also a very slow process. Trials take time, and you have to be prepared for that. You must be strong for your sister. She straightens at that, wanting, as we all do, to get it right for Amy. We go on and take turns and field questions. After a while, we let the subject drop, talking about other things, trying to enjoy ourselves and our Mexican meal. Lucille's staccato laugh interrupts the table near us when I act silly with my watch cap. Back out on the winter street, I watch Julie walk away with her boyfriend, the bereft little sister who has had to grow up too fast. Young as she is, she has such strong echoes of her mother's dignity. I go on my own way, hoping I've done a good enough job. I'm overwhelmed with guilt, telling Diane and Julie that the system will work and the jury will see through the muck and mire. Inside, I don't know what to expect. Later, Fern La Rochelle would say it was the most amazing thing he had seen in 30 years of trying cases. Often, some members of a jury pool will have heard something about a case. Sometimes, several prospective jurors will have. This time, 67 out of 70 indicated in response to the judge's questioning that they had heard something about the case. During the many weeks Amy had been missing, ordinary citizens all over the state had followed the news, hoping for the best and fearing the worst. After a very long day of jury selection, which involved individual interviews by the judge and the attorneys with nearly every juror to ascertain what they had heard about the case and whether it had affected their ability to render an impartial decision, a panel of 12 jurors and 3 alternates was finally seated and instructed to be back at the courthouse on Monday morning by 8:30 a.m. to begin their service as the jury in the matter of State v. Gorman. The jurors left with instructions not to read about the case, not to watch or listen to any news programs about it, and not to discuss it with anyone, not even spouses or members of their family. La Rochelle, Stokes, and the detectives left with anxious stomachs and the certainty of a busy weekend ahead. A criminal jury trial is a highly artificial process, circumscribed by a great number of rules that have evolved to avoid any prejudice to the defendant, who is, under our system of justice, presumed innocent until proven guilty. One of the hardest and saddest results of that, from the viewpoint of the investigators in a case and the victim's family, is how little of the story ever actually gets told. By the time the case to be presented in State v. Gorman was delineated by pretrial discussion and agreement, and by the amount of information about Gorman that was excluded because of its prejudicial value, the jury would get only a very diminished picture of his character, or the extent of his personal corruption and his propensity for violence, and none of his long history of predatory behavior. They would not hear about his extensive criminal history. They would not hear, for example, that he had befriended a man in his 80s solely for the purpose of stealing the man's few valuable belongings. They would not hear that he had assaulted his mother during a screaming fight after he had broken into a neighbor's house and stolen guns. Nor would they hear he had punched and kicked his pregnant girlfriend and assaulted a teacher at school. They would not hear he had broken into customers' cars at the dealership where he worked and stolen stereo equipment to resell. No one would come to the stand to tell the jury that Gorman was a drug dealer, drug user, and heavy drinker. They would not hear the evidence that had led the detectives to conclude he was a sexual predator. None of the women he had drugged and violated would take the stand. The jury, which was to evaluate whether they could decide beyond a reasonable doubt that Russ Gorman had murdered Amy St. Laurent by shooting her in the head, might hear that Gorman didn't like guns. They would not hear that Gorman had gone to Alabama, because that might make it look as though he had fled the state. They would therefore not hear that Gorman had immediately acquired a gun in Alabama and had probably had another gun stored in his grandmother's ceiling. They would not hear about Gorman's using one of those guns to threaten a stranger in a Blimpie's parking lot. They would not hear how Gorman had hidden himself and his guns in a house with a small child, nor about the armed standoff that had followed. Even sadder, they would hear little about Gorman's victim. Although the trial was for the murder of Amy Elizabeth St. Laurent, the citizens called to determine her accused killer's fate would learn little of what the investigators who had worked so hard on her behalf had learned. They would never get to imagine what the world had lost when a self-involved young man with sex on his mind, poor impulse control, and a total lack of empathy had snuffed out a bright light because that principled young woman had resisted a sexual assault. They would never have a chance to picture the forthright, compassionate, and intelligent young woman Danny Young and Scott Heracles called Our Amy. Nor would they have the chance to understand how two hard-boiled detectives who dealt with horrendous crimes and with crime victims every day of their working lives could become so attached to this victim that one kept her picture on his desk while the other told people she was the kind of girl you would be proud to have raised. A jury trial is also a highly scripted event, Because both sides have submitted their lists of witnesses and subpoenaed them to appear, the cast of characters is usually well known. The proposed exhibits have been identified, discussed, and largely agreed on before trial. Areas of potential conflict have also been identified. Experienced attorneys have anticipated legal issues that will be in dispute, often having researched the case law and prepared memoranda for the court in support of their positions. Even with all this preparation, trial lawyers have to be quick on their feet and intimately familiar with all the details of the investigation and the reams of paper that a complex investigation produces. A case as complex as the Amy St. Laurent murder really needed two prosecutors, one on his feet and another listening, taking notes, ready to quickly produce documents or find a place in a document. For despite careful preparation, witnesses will lie, forget, change their stories, fall apart, and generally produce surprises. And defense attorneys will rattle witnesses, color stories, and muddy waters that will need to be resettled. For the jury in State v. Gorman, Monday, January 13th, began with opening statements from the attorneys representing the state and the defendant. But long before the judge greeted the jury, the behind-the-scenes skirmishing about how to handle Tammy Westbrook's convenient amnesia had begun. In mid-morning, during this first day of the trial, the attorneys held a conference within the judge's chambers in which Bill Stokes told Justice Mills that during the morning break, Attorney Lilly had handed him an affidavit detailing Westbrook's lack of memory and asking that her subpoena to testify be quashed and she be allowed to remain in the courtroom during her son's trial. The week of the trial, I would wear a suit and tie so I could run across the street to the courthouse when my regular duties would allow. I also spoke with Diane, Lucille, Tommy, and Danny each night to obtain details. Sometimes, sitting there listening to the maddening variety of interpretations, I would wonder what the jury could possibly be thinking. I missed the first morning, but everyone reported that Fern had done a wonderful job in his opening remarks, as he urged the jury to use common sense in putting the pieces of evidence together. It's a difficult undertaking for them, since the evidence comes in broken fragments from a handful of witnesses gleaned from the many we've interviewed. The defense, of course, argues reasonable doubt. No murder weapon, no physical evidence. It's a purely circumstantial case, and the witnesses are mixed up in their accounts and memories of events. I'm so cynical about reasonable doubt that I believe I could convince the reader that there is reasonable doubt that you are reading this right now. Gorman's lawyer, Clifford Strike, is an ethical and honorable individual who is doing his job. But when everyone does their job, the result is a process that is perplexing and complex for the jury, the public, and the family. Sometimes, to those of us who know the story, it seems almost ridiculous. At lunch, Tom tells me to get over to the courtroom. Lily has filed a motion seeking to prevent Tammy Westbrook from taking the stand. Around 1300, I meet the family in the hallway outside the old Superior Courtroom. It's a room I've been in many times over the years, an old-fashioned, formal, judicial-looking room with polished marble floors and beautiful dark wood detailing. Tension is high as we wait outside on a long wooden bench. Diane is angry that Gorman is paraded within feet of them as he takes his place with his attorney. She is also upset that court security is limiting the number of people inside according to the seats. I try to explain the process to Diane and Julie as I study their tired, strained faces. I have very limited authority in the courtroom, I explain, and these things are out of my control. The court officer announces that court will be in session, and we shuffle into the room's audience area, a small box-like section of uncomfortable wooden benches that were squeezed into like sardines. Gorman is escorted in from the left, only a few feet away. Once again, I feel that visceral revulsion toward him I am trained to keep off my face. Gorman has morphed again, no longer the pretty blonde boy or the shaved-head young tough. He's much heavier now, paunchy, sloppy, and tired. No more Mr. Charming with that innocent young "who, me?" look that fooled so many girls. This is much better for the jury, I think. I am surprised that they haven't done more to polish him up. Maybe he refused. He's arrogant enough to think he knows best. Hey, Jeffrey, how about a mea culpa when you get up there before the judge? Around me, I feel the family's tension as Dan Lilly appears, and the attorneys begin to deal with Tammy Westbrook's move to avoid testifying and to be allowed to stay in the courtroom with her son. It's difficult to watch Lily parade around discussing Tammy's memory loss. I am relieved when Justice Mills quickly shuts it down. The trial will not be delayed, she says. The motion will be heard in the morning before the jury comes in. It's not up to me to judge the credibility of this witness in advance. That is for the 12 members of the jury to decide. At least it's not a slam dunk for Lily and the defense. The family half relaxes, at least for now. The trial is going forward, but the decision is only delayed. We will all carry the uncertainty home tonight. After discussion, the judge took the firm position that Ms. Westbrook was still under subpoena, was still sequestered, and the matter would be heard the following morning before the jury returned to begin the second day of the trial. The trial then went on with the succession of the roommates at 230 Brighton Avenue stumbling through their incoherent versions of what had taken place the night Amy disappeared, an inconsistent jumble of times and assertions that Gorman was or wasn't in the apartment and had or hadn't discussed the time of his return with his roommates before they were interviewed by the police, interspersed with the chillingly banal testimony of three witnesses that Gorman had casually discussed with them his intention to bring Amy back to the apartment for sex. These witnesses were followed by Westbrook police officer Tim Gardner, who testified about stopping Gordon for a high beam violation at 3:14 a.m. on the morning of October 21, 2001. Gardner described the routine of a traffic stop, said that he had observed Gorman to see if he was intoxicated, and said that Gorman had been visibly nervous and was the sole occupant of the vehicle. He then located the traffic stop on a map. In the courtroom, watching all this unfold, were the family and friends who had now waited more than a year to see some kind of closure to the brutal death of a beloved girl. Amy's mother, Diane Jenkins, Amy's father, Dennis St. Laurent, and her second mother, Kathy Emery, Amy's sister, Julie, Amy's last boyfriend, Richard Sparrow, and Diane's friend, Lucille Holt, all accompanied by the victim witness advocates from both the Portland Police Department and the Attorney General's office, Janice Hackett and Susie Miller. These courageous and fearful people would need all the support they could get as they listened to the last witness of the day, Dr. Margaret Greenwald, the state chief medical examiner, describe the exhumation and autopsy of Amy's body. Along with her description of the gunshot wound and other injuries, Dr. Greenwald gave a detailed description of the appropriate methods for collection of insect larvae found with the body. Those larvae would play a crucial evidentiary role in establishing a time frame for Amy's death and subsequent burial. La Rochelle. At any point during the examination, were insect larvae collected? Greenwald. Yes, they were. As we were removing the clothes, we could see that there were some larger larvae and pupae, which was sort of a large black eggs that the larvae pupae are in until they become adults, and there was some of the larvae over the right arm and shoulder area, and as we were looking through the dirt, we saw some smaller larvae which were over the lower extremities. La Rochelle, these were collected? Greenwald, yes. La Rochelle, what was done with them? Greenwald, some of them were placed in a container that had a paper towel, and was moist and had some vermiculite to allow them to survive, to live. Some of them were placed in a solution of alcohol and glycerin, which would kill them and preserve them at the state in which we found them. La Rochelle. All right. What's the point of treating them differently? Greenwald. The entomologist examining them can see them at the exact state that we did if they were killed, so they know what size or age they are, and then having a live larvae, it will allow them to grow the larva so they can see how long it takes them to reach adulthood. In a world where people are fed a steady diet of fictional and true crime on television and in the movies, it is difficult to shift from such riveting yet rather clinically emotionless entertainment to imagine how it must feel to be a parent in a courtroom, listening to someone describe your child's state of undress, decomposition, and the necessity to reassemble that child's skull in order to determine the cause of her death, hearing about the removal of her fingernails, the evidence of a freshly chipped tooth, bruised lips, and broken facial bones telling of pre-mortem blows to her face, the back-and-forth interrogation about the presence or absence of stippling in an effort to determine whether a handgun was used, the inability to get meaningful toxicity results because of the advanced state of decomposition. It was grueling for Amy's family to sit in the courtroom, dedicated and stoic as her earthly representatives, and hear such things associated with a person they loved, while Gorman, so very much alive, slouched in front of them, turning from time to time to stare and smirk. At the end of day one, the jurors and the family went home exhausted. The cops and prosecutors went back to work. Chapter 18. The second day of the trial began without the jury in attendance. It began with arguments about Tammy Westbrook's claim that she had no memory of her phone call with her son or her appearance before the grand jury. Although the state had anticipated some maneuver by Westbrook, they had been uncertain how she would approach her pending testimony or what her claims would be when she arrived at the courthouse. Attorney Lilly's delivery of the affidavit and motion to quash had clarified her position. Out of the jury's hearing, the attorneys debated whether Westbrook's subpoena to testify should be quashed, enabling Westbrook to be present in the courtroom during her son's trial rather than being sequestered like the other witnesses. Westbrook's attorney argued that, as the affidavit stated, she had no memory of events surrounding the death of the victim, and therefore it would be fruitless to call her. Gorman's attorney took no position. The prosecuting attorneys contested the fact that Westbrook lacked a reasonable ability to remember, asserting that it was a matter for the court to determine after examining the witness. With Westbrook's evidence as a centerpiece of their case, they were prepared to fight long and hard to get it before the jury. It was dramatic, it was damning, and it would explain to the jury what had really happened the night Gorman claimed he'd dropped Amy off, gone home, and stayed in for the rest of the night. Based on her reading of the rules, the judge decided to conduct an examination of Westbrook to determine whether or not she had any ability to recall the time of the events in question. Westbrook's attorney countered that because the state contended her claim of memory loss was untruthful, Westbrook might be subject to sanctions such as perjury or contempt of court, and therefore, arguably, had a Fifth Amendment right to decline to answer questions that the judge might pose. Justice Mills refused to decide the issue of Westbrook's memory, or lack thereof, solely on the strength of a sworn statement claiming memory loss. Instead, she stated that she intended to conduct a voir dire, questioning the witness about her memory in general, and in particular, her memory of events around the time and events at issue. The attorneys would be allowed to question her as well. Justice Mills and the attorneys went on to discuss the pressing question of whether Westbrook's grand jury testimony would be used only to impeach her credibility as a witness, or whether, despite the traditionally secret and one-sided nature of grand jury testimony, it could be offered as substantive evidence. It was an important distinction. If the testimony was admitted as substantive, as a confession by Jeffrey Gorman of what he had done, it could be used as part of the factual basis for a conviction. Bill Stokes argued that if Westbrook persisted in her claim of a lack of memory, her prior testimony before the grand jury was admissible as substantive evidence. He reminded the court that Westbrook had already tried to avoid testifying before the grand jury, appearing in response to her subpoena and stating she wouldn't testify. She had then been sworn in, had appeared before the grand jury, had been asked some preliminary questions, and had refused to answer. She had been taken before Superior Court Justice Humphrey, advised of her duty to give her testimony, and offered the opportunity to consult an attorney. She had returned the following day with an attorney and been told by Justice Humphrey she had no basis for refusal and that she must testify. Only then had she gone forward and given her testimony. Now, with Westbrook finally on the stand in open court on this second morning of the trial, Stokes questioned her about some of her grand jury testimony. In response to the question, "Nevertheless, are you prepared to come here this morning and tell the truth?" Westbrook had stated to the grand jury, "I have always wanted to tell the truth. I just never wanted to talk. I just wanted the justice system to do their job and let justice be served and let me out of it, because I certainly don't want to testify at any trial." She had also told the grand jury with respect to the phone call in which her son confessed, "I will never forget it as long as I live." Queried now during the trial about that testimony and those statements made to the grand jury, she studied the transcript and responded, "This is like reading a book. I do not remember this, sir." By the conclusion of her examination, Stokes, Strike, and the judge had all had a turn to question Westbrook. She had exhibited knowledge of where she presently lived, where she was living at the time Amy St. Laurent disappeared, who her family members were, and the details of her medical condition caused by the stress of having her son accused of murder. She had also described numerous contacts with the police during the investigation in which she complained that they had accused her son, and she had described being annoyed by search helicopters flying overhead. The attorneys then argued the issue of quashing the subpoena. After argument, the judge found that Westbrook could, as the rules required, recall the matter, and that the jury was entitled to hear her and make up its own mind. The motion to quash the subpoena was denied, and Westbrook was ordered to remain sequestered. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Main Reader. We are reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is The Main Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.